This is Rachel recording for Radio Talking Book Network in Omaha, Nebraska. I will be reading Bookshelf, starting with Part 8 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Dr. Seward's Diary. 22nd of September. It is all over. Arthur has gone back to Ring and has taken Quincy Morris with him. What a fine fellow is Quincy. I believe in my heart of hearts that he suffered as much about Lucy's death as any of us, but he bore himself through it, like a moral Viking. If America can go on breeding men like that, she will be a power in the world indeed. Van Helsing is lying down, having a rest preparatory to his journey. He goes over to Amsterdam tonight, but says that he returns tomorrow night, that he only wants to make some arrangements which can only be made personally. He is to stop with me then, if he can. He says he has work to do in London, which may take him some time. Poor fellow. I feel that the strain of the past week has broken down even his iron strength. All the time of the burial he was, I could see, putting some terrible restraint on himself. When it was all over, we were standing beside Arthur, who, poor fellow, was speaking of his part in the operation where his blood had been transfused to his Lucy's veins. I could see Van Helsing's face grow white and purple by turns. Arthur was saying that he felt since then as if they two had been really married, and that she was his wife in the sight of God. None of us said a word of the other operations, and none of us ever shall. Arthur and Quincy went away together to the station, and Van Helsing and I came on here. The moment we were alone in the carriage, he gave way to a regular fit of hysterics. He has denied to me since that it was hysterics, and insisted it was only his sense of humor asserting itself under very terrible conditions. He laughed till he cried, and I had to draw down the blinds lest anyone should see us and misjudge. And then he cried till he laughed again, and laughed and cried together, just as a woman does. I tried to be stern with him, as one is to a woman under the circumstances, but it had no effect. Men and women are so different in manifestations of nervous strength or weaknessness. And then when his face grew grave and stern again, I asked him why his mirth, and why at such a time. His reply was in a way characteristic of him, for it was logical, and forceful, and mysterious. He said, "Ah, you don't comprehend, friend John. I do not think that I am not sad, though I laugh. See, I have cried even when the laugh did choke me. But no more think that I am all sorry when I cry, for the laugh he come just the same. Keep it always with you, that laughter who knock at your door and say, 'May I come in?' is not the true laughter. No. He is a king, and he come when and how he like. He ask no person, he choose no time for suitability. He say, 'I am here.' Behold, an example, I grieve my heart out for that so sweet young girl. I give my blood for her, though I am old and worn. I give my time, my skill, my sleep. I let my other sufferers want that so she may have all. And yet I can laugh at her very grave, laugh when the clay from the spade of the sexton drop upon her coffin and say, 'Thud, thud,' to my heart, till it send back the blood from my cheek. My heart bleed for that poor boy, that dear boy, so of the age of mine own boy had I been blessed that he live, with his hair and eyes the same. There, you know now why I love him so, and yet, when he say things that touch my husband heart to the quick and make my father heart yearn for him as no other man, not even to you, friend John, for we are more level in experiences than father and son. Yet even at such a moment, King Laugh, he come to me and shout and bellow in my ear, 'Here I am, here I am,' till the blood come dance back and bring some of the sunshine that he carry with him to his cheek. Oh, friend John, it is a strange world, a sad world, a world full of miseries and woes and troubles, and yet, when King Laugh come, he make them all dance to the tune he play. Bleeding hearts, and dry bones of the churchyard, and tears that burn as they fall, all dance together to the music he make with that smileless mouth of him. And believe me, friend John, that he is good to come and kind. We men and women are like ropes drawn tight with strain that pull us in different ways. Then tears come, and like the rain on the ropes, they brace us up until perhaps the strain become too great and we break. But King Laugh, he come like the sunshine, and he ease off the strain again, and we bear to go on with the labor, what it may be. I did not like to wound him by pretending not to see his idea, but as I did not yet understand the cause of his laughter, I asked him. As he answered me, his face grew stern, and he said in quite a different tone, "Oh, it was the grim irony of it all. This so lovely lady garlanded with flowers that looked so fair in life, till one by one we wondered if she were truly dead. She laid in that so fine marble house in that lonely churchyard where rest so many of her kin, laid there with the mother who loved her and whom she loved, and that sacred bell going tall, 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 so sad and slow. These holy men with the white garments of the angel pretending to read books, and yet all the time their eyes never on the page, and all of us with the bowed head. And all for what? She is dead, so, is it not?" "Well, for the life of me, Professor," I said, "I can't see anything to laugh in all of that. Why, your explanation makes it a harder puzzle than before. Even if the burial service was comic, what about poor Art and his trouble? Why, his heart is simply breaking." "Just so. Said he not that the transfusion of his blood to her veins had made her truly his bride?" "Yes, it was quite a sweet and comforting idea for him." "Quite so. But there was a difficulty, friend John. If so that, then what about the others? Ho, ho! Then this sweet maid is a polyandrist. And with me, with my poor wife dead to me, but alive by church's law, though no wits, all gone, even I, who am faithful husband to this now no wife, am bigamist. I don't see where the joke comes in there, either," I said, and did not feel particularly pleased with him saying such things. He laid his hand on my arm and said, "Friend John, forgive me if I pain. I showed not my feeling to others when it would wound, but only to you, my old friend, whom I can trust. If you could have looked into my very heart that when I want to laugh, if you could have done so when the laugh arrived, if you could do so now, when King Laugh hath packed up his crown and all that is him, he would go far, far away from me, and for a long, long time. Perhaps you would pity me most of all." I was touched by the tenderness of his tone, and asked why. "Because I know." And now we are all scattered, and for many a long day loneliness will sit on our roofs with brooding wings. Lucy lies in the tomb of her kin, a lordly death house in a lonely churchyard away from teeming London, where the air is fresh, and the sun rises over Hampstead Hill, and where wild flowers grow of their own accord. So I can finish this diary, and God only knows if I shall ever begin another. If I do, or if I ever open this again, it will be to deal with different people, and different things. For here at the end, where the romance of my life is told, ere I go back to take up the thread of my life work, I say sadly, and without hope, Finis. The Westminster Gazette, 25th of September. A Hampstead Mystery. The neighborhood of Hampstead is just at present exercised with a series of events which seem to run on lines parallel to those of what was known to the writers of the headlines as the Kensington Horror, or the Stabbing Woman, or the Woman in Black. During the past 2 or 3 days, several cases have occurred of young children straying from home or neglecting to return from their playing on the heath. In all these cases, the children were too young to give any properly intelligible account of themselves, but the consensus of their excuses is that they had been with a bloofer lady. It's always been late in the evening when they have been missed, and on 2 occasions, children have not been found until early the following morning. It is generally supposed that in the neighborhood that, as the first child missed gave his reason for being away with a beautiful lady, had asked him to come for a walk, the others had picked up the phrase and used it as occasion served. This is the more natural, as the favorite game of the little ones at present is luring each other away by wiles. A correspondent writes us that to see some of the tiny tots pretending to be the bloofer lady is supremely funny. Some of our caricaturists might, he says, take a lesson in the irony of grotesque by comparing the reality and the picture. It is only in accordance with general principles of human nature that the beautiful lady should be the popular role at these alfresco performances. Our correspondent naively says that even Ellen Terry could not be so winningly attractive as some of these grubby-faced little children pretend and even imagine themselves to be. There is, however, possibly a serious side to the question, for some of the children, indeed all who have been missed at night, have been slightly torn or wounded in the throat. The wounds seem such as might have been made by a rat or small dog, and although of not much importance individually, would tend to show that whatever animal inflicts them has a system or method of its own. The police of the division have been instructed to keep a sharp lookout for straying children, especially when very young, in and around Hampstead Heath, and for any stray dog which may be about. The Westminster Gazette, 25th of September. Extra special, The Hampstead Horror. Another child injured, the bloofer lady. We have just received intelligence that another child, missed last night, was only discovered late in the morning under a furze bush at the Shooter's Hillside of Hampstead Heath, which is perhaps less frequented than the other parts. It has the same tiny neck wound in the throat as has been noticed in other cases. It is terribly weak and looked quite emaciated. It, too, when partially restored, had the common story to tell of being lured away by the beautiful lady. Mina Harker's Journal, 23rd of September. Jonathan is better after a bad night. I'm so glad he has plenty of work to do, for that keeps his mind off the terrible things. And oh, I am rejoiced that he is not now weighed down with the responsibility of his new position. I knew he would be true to himself, and how proud I am to see my Jonathan rising to the height of his advancement and keeping pace in all the ways with the duties that come upon him. He will be away all day till late, for he said he could not lunch at home. My household work is done, so I shall take his foreign journal and lock myself up in my room and read it. 24th of September. I hadn't the heart to write last night. That terrible record of Jonathan's upset me so. Poor dear! How he must have suffered, whether it be true or only imagination. I wonder if there be any truth in it at all. Did he get his brain fever and then write all those terrible things? Or had he some cause for it all? I suppose I shall never know, for I dare not open the subject to him. And yet that man we saw yesterday, he seemed quite certain of him. Poor fellow. I suppose it was the funeral upset him and sent his mind back on some train of thought. He believes it all himself. I remember how on our wedding day he said, "Unless some solemn duty come upon me to go back to the bitter hours, asleep or awake, mad or sane." There seems to be through it all some thread of continuity. That fearful count was coming to London. If it should be, and he came to London with its teeming millions, there may be a solemn duty, and if it come, we must not shrink from it. I shall be prepared. I shall get my typewriter this very hour and begin transcribing, and then we shall be ready for other eyes if required. And if it be wanted, then, perhaps, if I am ready, poor Jonathan may not be upset, for I can speak for him, and never let him be troubled or worried with it at all. If ever Jonathan quite gets over the nervousness, he may want to tell me of it all, and I can ask him questions and find out things and see how I may comfort him. Letter, Van Helsing to Miss Harker. 24th of September, Confidence. Dear Madam, I pray you to pardon my writing in that I am so far friend as that I sent to you sad news of Miss Lucy Westenra's death. By the kindness of Lord Godalming, I am empowered to read her letters and papers, for I am deeply concerned about certain matters vitally important. In them, I find some letters to you which show how great friends you were and how you love her. Oh, Madam Mina, by that love I implore you, help me. It is for others' good that I ask, to redress great wrong, and to lift much and terrible troubles that may be more great than you can know. May it be that I see you? You can trust me. I am friend of Dr. John Seward and of Lord Godalming. That was Arthur of Miss Lucy. I must keep it private for the present from all. I should come to Exeter to see you at once, if you tell me I am privileged to come, and where and when. I implore your pardon, madam. I have read your letters to poor Lucy, and know how good you are, and how your husband suffer. So, I pray you, if it may be, enlighten him not, lest it may harm. Again your pardon, and forgive me. Van Helsing. Telegram, Mrs. Harker to Van Helsing. 25th of September. Come today, by 10:15 train, if you can catch it. Can see you any time you call. Wilhelmina Harker. Miss Harker's Journal. 25th of September. I cannot help feeling terribly excited as the time draws near for the visit from Dr. Van Helsing, for somehow I expect that it will throw some light onto Jonathan's sad experience, and as he attended poor dear Lucy in her last illness, he can tell me about her. That is the reason of his coming. It is concerning Lucy and her sleepwalking, and not about Jonathan. Then I shall never know the real truth now. How silly I am! That awful journal gets hold of my imagination and tinges everything with something of its own color. Of course it is about Lucy. That habit came back to the poor dear, and that awful night on the cliff must have made her ill. I've almost forgotten, in my own affairs, how ill she was afterwards. She must have told him of her sleepwalking adventure on the cliff, and that I knew all about it, and now he wants me to tell him about it, so that he may understand. I hope I did right in not saying anything of it to Mrs. Westenra. I never should never forgive myself if any act of mine, were it even a negative one, brought harm on poor, dear Lucy. I hope, too, that Dr. Van Helsing will not blame me. I have never had so much trouble and anxiety of late that I feel I cannot bear more just at present. I suppose a cry does us all good sometimes, clears the air as other rain does. Perhaps it was reading the journal yesterday that upset me, and then Jonathan went away this morning to stay away from me a whole day and night, the first time we've been parted since our marriage. I do hope the dear fellow will take care of himself and that nothing will occur to upset him. It is 2:00, and the doctor will be here soon now. I shall say nothing of Jonathan's journal unless he asks me. I'm so glad to have typewritten out my own journal, so that in case he asks about Lucy, I can hand it to him. It will save so much questioning. Later. He has come and gone. Oh, what a strange meeting, and how it all makes my head whirl around. I feel like one in a dream. Can it be at all possible, or even a part of it? If I had not read Jonathan's journal first, I should never have accepted even a possibility. Poor, poor, dear Jonathan. How he must have suffered. Please, the good God, all this may not upset him again. I shall try to save him from it, but it may even be a consolation and a help to him, terrible though it be, and awful in its consequences, to know for certain that his eyes and ears and brain did not deceive him, and that it is all true. It may be that it is the doubt which haunts him, that when the doubt is removed, no matter which, waking or dreaming, may prove the truth, he will be more satisfied and better able to bear the shock. Dr. Van Helsing must be a good man as well as a clever one if he is Arthur's friend and Dr. Seward's, and if they brought him all the way from Holland to look after Lucy. I feel from having seen him that he is good and kind and of a noble nature. When he comes tomorrow, I shall ask him about Jonathan. And then, please God, all this sorrow and anxiety may lead to a good end. I used to think I would like to practice interviewing. Jonathan's friend on the Exeter News told him that memory was everything in such work, that you must be able to put down exactly almost every word spoken, even if you had to refine some of it afterwards. Here was a rare interview. I shall try to record it verbatim. It was 2:30 when the knock came. I took my courage à deux mains and waited. In a few minutes, Mary opened the door and announced Dr. Van Helsing. I rose and bowed, and he came towards me, a man of medium height, strongly built, with his shoulders set back over a broad, deep chest, and a neck well balanced on the trunk as the head is on the neck. The poise of the head strikes one at once as indicative of thought and power. The head is noble, well-sized, broad, and large behind the ears. The face, clean-shaven, shows a hard, square chin, a large, resolute, mobile mouth, a good-sized nose, rather straight, but with quick, sensitive nostrils that seem to broaden as the big, bushy brows come down and the mouth tightens. The forehead is broad and fine, rising at first almost straight, and then sloping back above two bumps or ridges wide apart. Such a forehead that the reddish hair cannot possibly tumble over it, but falls naturally back into the sides. Big, dark blue eyes are set widely apart, but are quick and tender, or stern with the man's moods. He said to me, "Miss Harker, is it not?" I bowed assent. "That was Miss Mina Murray?" Again I assented. "It is Mina Murray that I came to see that was the friend of that poor, dear child Lucy Westenra. Madam Mina, it is on account of the dead I come." "Sir," I said, "you could have no better claim on me than you were a friend and helper of Lucy Westenra." I held out my hand. He took it and said tenderly, "Oh, Madam Mina, I knew that the friend of that poor lily girl must be good, but I had yet to learn." He finished his speech with a courtly bow. I asked him what it was that he wanted to see me about, so he once began, "I've read your letters to Miss Lucy. Forgive me, but I had to begin to inquire somewhere, and there was none to ask. I know that you were with her at Whitby. She sometimes kept a diary. You need not look surprised, Madam Mina. It was begun after you left, and was made in imitation of you. And in that diary she traces by inference several things to a sleepwalking in which she puts down you saved her. In great perplexity, then, I come to you, and ask you out of your own so much kindness to tell me all of you can remember." "I can tell you, I think, Dr. Van Helsing, all about it." "Ah, you have good memory for facts, for details. It is not always so with young ladies." "No, doctor, but I wrote it down at the time. I can show it to you if you like." "Oh, Madam Mina, I will be grateful. You will do me much favor." I could not resist the temptation of mystifying him a bit. I suppose it is some of the taste of the original apple that remains still in our mouths. So I handed him the shorthand diary. He took it with a grateful bow and said, "May I read it?" "If you wish," I answered as demurely as I could. He opened it, and for an instant his face fell, and then he stood up and bowed. "Oh, you so clever woman," he said. "I long knew that Mr. Jonathan was a man of much thankfulness, but see, his wife have all the good things. Will you not so much honor me and so help me as to read it for me? Alas, I know not the shorthand." By this time my little joke was over, and I was almost ashamed, so I took the typewritten copy from my work basket and handed it to him. "Forgive me," I said, "I could not help it. I had been thinking of it that it was of dear Lucy that you wished to ask, and so you might not have to wait, not on my account, but because I know your time must be precious, I've written it out on the typewriter for you." He took it, and his eyes glistened. "You are so good," he said, "and may I read it now? I may want to ask you some things when I've read." "By all means," I said. "Read over it whilst I order lunch, and then you can ask me questions whilst we eat." He bowed and settled himself in a chair, and with his back to the light, and became absorbed in the papers, whilst I went to see after lunch, chiefly in order that he might not be disturbed. When I came back, I found him walking hurriedly up and down the room, his face all ablaze with excitement. He rushed to me and took me by both hands. "Oh, Madam Mina," he said, "how can I say what I owe to you? This paper is as sunshine. It opens the gate to me. I am dazed. I am dazzled with so much light, and yet clouds roll in behind the light every time. But that you do not, cannot, comprehend. Oh, but I am grateful to you, you so clever woman. Madam," he said this very solemnly, "if ever Abraham Van Helsing can do anything for you or yours, I trust you will let me know. It will be pleasure and delight if I may serve you as a friend, as a friend. But all I have ever learned, all I can ever do, shall be for you and those you love. There are darknesses in life, and there are lights. You are one of the lights. You will have happy life and good life, and your husband will be blessed in you. But, doctor, you praise me too much, and you do not know me. Not know you? I, who am old, and who have studied all my life men and women, I, who have made specialty the brain, and all that belongs to him and all that follow from him. I have read your diary that you have so goodly written to me, and which breathes out truth in every line. I, who have read your so sweet letter to poor Lucy of your marriage and your trust, not know you? Oh, Madam Mina, good women tell all their lives, and by day and by hour and by minute such things as angels can read. And we men who wish to know of us something of angels' eyes, your husband is noble nature, and you are noble too, for you trust, and trust cannot be where there is mean nature. And your husband, tell me of him. Is he quite well? Is that all fever gone, and he is strong and hearty? I saw here an opening to ask him about Jonathan, so I said, he's almost recovered, but he's been greatly upset by Mr. Hawkins' death. He interrupted. Oh, yes, I know, I know. I read your last two letters. I went on. I suppose this had upset him, for when we were in town on Thursday, he had a sort of shock. A shock? And after brain fever so soon? That was not good. What kind of shock was it? He thought he saw someone which recalled something terrible, something which led to his brain fever. And here the whole thing seemed to overwhelm me in a rush. The pity of Jonathan, the horror which he experienced, the whole fearful mystery of his diary, and the fear that has been brooding over me ever since, all came to a tumult. I suppose I was hysterical, for I threw myself on my knees and held up my hands to him and implored him to make my husband well again. He took my hands and raised me up and made me sit on the sofa and sat by me. He held my hand in his and said to me with, oh, such infinite sweetness, my life is a barren and lonely one, and so full of work that I had not had much time for friendships. But since I have been summoned to here by my friend John, I have known so much good people and seen such nobility that I feel more than ever, and it has grown with my advancing years, the loneliness of my life. Believe me, then, that I come here full of respect for you, and you have given me hope. Hope not in what I am seeking of, but that there are good women still left to make life happy. Good women, whose lives and whose truths may make good lesson for the children that are to be. I am glad, glad I may be here be of some use to you, for if your husband suffer, he suffer within the range of my study and experience. I promise you, I will gladly do all for him that I can, all to make his life strong and manly, and your life a happy one. Now you must eat. You are overwrought and perhaps over anxious. Husband Jonathan would not like to see you so pale, and what he like not where he love is not to his good. Therefore, for his sake you must eat and smile. You have told me all about Lucy, so now we shall not speak of it, lest it distress. I shall stay in Exeter tonight, for I want to think much over what you have told me, and when I have thought I will ask you questions, if I may. And then, too, you will tell me of husband Jonathan's trouble, so far as you can, but not yet. You must eat now. Afterward, you tell me all. After lunch, when we went back to the drawing room, he said to me, "And now tell me all about him." When it came to speaking to this great learned man, I began to fear that he would think me a weak fool, and Jonathan a madman. That journal is so strange, and I hesitated to go on. But he was sweet and kind, and he promised to help, and I trusted him. So I said, "Dr. Van Helsing, what I have to tell you is so queer, you must not laugh at me or at my husband. I've been since yesterday in a sort of fever or doubt. You must be kind to me, and do not think me foolish that I've ever even half believed some strange things." He reassured me by his manner as well as his words when he said, "Oh, my dear, if you only knew how strange is the matter regarding which I am here, it is you who would laugh. I have learned not to think little of anyone's belief, no matter how strange it be. I've tried to keep an open mind, And it is not the ordinary things of life that could close it, but the strange things, the extraordinary things, the things that make one doubt if they be mad or sane. Thank you. Thank you 1,000 times. You've taken a weight off my mind. If you will let me, I shall give you a paper to read. It is long, but I have typewritten it all out. It will tell you the trouble of Jonathan's. It is the copy of his journal when abroad, and all that happened. I dare not say anything of it. You will read for yourself and judge, and then when I see you, perhaps, you will be very kind and tell me what you think. I promise, he said, as I gave him the papers. I shall, in the morning, as soon as I can, come to see you and your husband, if I may. Jonathan will be here 11:30, and you must come to lunch with us and see him then. You could catch the quick 3:34 train, which will leave you at Paddington before 8. He was surprised at my knowledge of the trains offhand, but he does not know that I have made up all the trains to and from Exeter so that I might help Jonathan in case he's in a hurry. So he took the papers with him and went away, and I sat here thinking I don't know what. Letter, by hand, Van Helsing to Mrs. Harker, 25th of September, 6:00. Dear Madam Mina, I have read your husband's so wonderful diary. You may sleep without doubt. Strange and terrible it is. It is true. I will pledge my life on it. It may be worse for others, but for him and you, there is no dread. He is a noble fellow, and let me tell you from experience of men, that one who would do as he did in going down that wall into that room, aye, and going a second time, is not one to be injured in permanence by a shock. His brain and his heart are all right, this I swear, before I've even seen him. So be at rest. I have much to ask him of other things. I am blessed that today I come to see you, for I have learned all at once so much that again I am dazzle more than ever, and I must think. Yours, the most faithful, Abraham Van Helsing. Letter, Mrs. Harker to Van Helsing, 25th of September, 6:30 p.m. My dear Dr. Van Helsing, 1,000 thanks for your kind letter, which has taken a great weight off my mind. And yet, if it be true, what terrible things there are in the world, and what an awful thing if that man, that monster, be really in London. I fear to think. I have this moment, whilst writing, have a wire from Jonathan, saying that he leaves by the 6:25 tonight from Lanchester, and will be here at the 10:18, so that I have no fear tonight. Will you, therefore, instead of lunching with us, please come to breakfast at 8:00, if this not be too early for you? You can get away, if you're in a hurry, by the 10:30 train, which will bring you to Paddington by 2:35. Do not answer this, as I shall take it that if I do not hear, you will come to breakfast. Believe me, your faithful and grateful friend, Mina Harker. Jonathan Harker's Journal, 26th of September. I thought never to write in this diary again, but the time has come. When I got home last night, Mina had supper ready, and when we'd supped, she told me of Van Helsing's visit, and of her having given him the two diaries copied out, and of how anxious she'd been about me. She showed me the doctor's letter that I wrote down was true. It seems to have made a new man of me. It was the doubt as to the reality of the whole thing that knocked me over. I felt impotent, and in the dark, and distrustful. But now that I know, I'm not afraid, even of the Count. He has succeeded after all, then, in his design in getting to London, and it was he I saw. He has got younger, and how? Van Helsing is the man to unmask him, and hunt him out, if he is anything like what Mina says. We sat late and talked it all over. Mina is dressing, and I shall call at the hotel in a few minutes and bring him over. He was, I think, surprised to see me. When I came into the room where he was and introduced myself, he took me by the shoulder and turned my face round to the light and said, after a sharp scrutiny, "But Madam Mina told me you were ill, that you had had a shock." It was so funny to hear my wife called Madam Mina by this kindly, strong-faced old man. I smiled and said, "I was ill. I have had a shock, but you've cured me already." "And how?" "By your letter to Mina last night. I was in doubt, and then everything took a hue of unreality. and I did not know what to trust, even the evidence of my own senses. Not knowing what to trust, I did not know what to do, and so had only to keep on working in what had hitherto been the groove of my life. The groove ceased to avail me, and I mistrusted myself. Doctor, you don't know what it is to doubt everything, even yourself. No, you don't. You couldn't, with eyebrows like yours. He seemed pleased, and laughed when he said, "So, you are a physiognomist. I learn more here with every hour. I with so much pleasure coming to you to breakfast, and oh, sir, you will pardon praise from an old man, but you are blessed in your wife." I could listen to him go on praising Mina for a day, so I simply nodded and stood silent. "She is one of God's women, fashioned by his own hand to show men and other women that there is a heaven where we can enter, and that its light can be here on earth. So true, so sweet, so noble, so little an egoist, and that, let me tell you, is much in this age so skeptical and selfish. And you, sir, I've read all the letters to poor Miss Lucy, and some of them speak of you, so I know you since some days from the knowing of others, and I have seen your true self since last night. You will give me your hand, will you not? And let us be friends all our lives." We shook hands, and he was so earnest and kind, it made me quite choky. "And now," he said, "may I ask of you some more help? I have a great task to do, and at the beginning it is to know. You can help me here. What can you tell me of what went before your going to Transylvania? Later on I may ask more help and of a different kind, but at first this will do." "Look here, sir," I said. "Does what you have to do concern the Count?" "It does," he said solemnly. "Then I am with you, heart and soul. As you go by the 10:30 train, you will not have time to read them, but I shall get the bundle of papers. You can take them with you and read them on the train." After breakfast, I saw him to the station. When we were parting, he said, "Perhaps you will come to town if I send to you, and take Madame Mina, too." "We shall both come when you will," I said. I got him the morning papers and the London papers of the previous night, and while we were talking at the carriage window, waiting for the train to start, he was turning them over. His eye suddenly seemed to catch something in one of them, the Westminster Gazette. I knew it by the color, and he grew quite white. He read something intently, groaning to himself, "Mein Gott, so soon, so soon!" I do not think he remembered me at the moment. Just then the whistle blew and the train moved off. This recalled him to himself, and he leaned out of the window and waved his hand, calling out, "Love to Madame Mina. I shall write so soon as ever I can." Dr. Seward's Diary. 26th of September. Truly there is no such thing as finality. Not a week since I said finis, and yet here I am, starting fresh again. Or rather, going on with the same record. Until this afternoon, I had no cause to think of what is done. Renfield had become, to all intents, as sane as he ever was. He was already well ahead with his fly business and had just started in the spider line also, so he had not been of any trouble to me. I had a letter from Arthur, written on Sunday, and from it I gather that he is bearing up wonderfully well. Quincy Morris is with him, and that is much of a help, for he himself is a bubbling well of good spirits. Quincy wrote me a line, too, and from him I hear that Arthur is beginning to recover something of his old buoyancy, and so, as to them, all my mind is at rest. As for myself, I was settling down to my work, with the enthusiasm which I used to have for it, so that I might fairly have been said that the wound which poor Lucy left on me was becoming citrusized. Everything is, however, now reopened, and that is to be the end. God only knows. I have an idea that Van Helsing thinks he knows, too, for he will only let out enough at a time to whet curiosity. He went to Exeter yesterday, and stayed there all the night. Today he came back, and almost bounded into the room about 5:30, and thrust last night's Westminster Gazette into my hand. "What do you think of that?" he asked as he stood back and folded his arms. I looked over the paper, for I really did not know what he meant. But he took it from me and pointed out a paragraph about children being decoyed away at Hampstead. It did not convey much to me until I reached a passage where it described small, punctured wounds on their throats. An idea struck me and I looked up. Well, he said, it is like poor Lucy's. And what do you make of it? Simply that there is some cause in common. Whatever it was that injured her injured them. I did not quite understand his answer. That is true indirectly, but not directly. How do you mean, Professor? I asked. I was a little inclined to take his seriousness lightly, for after all, 4 days of rest and freedom from burning, harrowing anxiety does help to restore one's spirits. But when I saw his face, it sobered me. Never, even in the midst of our despair about poor Lucy, had he looked more stern. Tell me, I said. I can hazard no opinion. I do not know what to think, and I have no data on which to found a conjecture. Do you mean to tell me, friend John, that you have no suspicion as to what poor Lucy died of? Not after all the hints given, not only by events, but by me. Of nervous prostration following on a great loss or waste of blood. And how was the blood lost or waste? I shook my head. He stepped over and sat down beside me and went on. You are a clever man, friend John. You reason well, and your wit is bold, but you are too prejudiced. You do not let your eyes see, nor your ears hear, and that which is outside your daily life is not of account to you. Do you not think there are some things which you cannot understand, and yet which are, that some people see things that others cannot? But there are things old and new which may not be contemplated by men's eyes, because they know, or think they know, some things which other men have told them. Ah, it is the fault of our science that wants to explain it all, and if it can explain not, it says there is nothing to explain. And yet, we see around us every day the growth of new beliefs which think themselves new, and which are yet but the old, which pretend to be young, like the fine ladies at the opera. I suppose now you do not believe in corporeal transference? No. Nor in materialization? No. Nor in astral bodies? No. Nor in the reading of thought? No. Nor in hypnotism? Yes, I said. Charcot has proved that pretty well. He smiled as he went on. Then you are satisfied as to it? Yes. And of course, then you understand how it act, and can follow the mind of the great Charcot, alas that he is no more, into the very soul of the patient that he influence. No? Then, friend John, am I to take it that you simply accept fact, and are satisfied to let from premise to conclusion be a blank? No? Then tell me, for I am a student of the brain, how you accept the hypnotism and reject the thought reading. Well, let me tell you, my friend, that there are things done today in electrical science which would have been deemed unholy by the very men who discovered electricity, who would themselves be not so long have been burned as wizards. There were always mysteries of life. Why was it that Methuselah lived 900 years, and old Parr 169, and yet poor Lucy, with 4 men's blood in her poor veins, could not live even one day? For had she lived one more day, we could save her. Do you know all the mystery of life and death? Do you know the altogether of comparative anatomy and can say wherefore the qualities of brutes are in some men and not in others? Can you tell me why, when other spiders die small and soon, one great spider lived for centuries in the tower of the old Spanish church and grew and grew and grew till on descending he could drink the oil of all the church lamps? Can you tell me why in the Pampas, aye, and elsewhere, there are bats that come at night and open the veins of cattle and horses and suck dry their veins, and on some islands of the western seas there are bats which hang on the trees all day, that those who have seen described like giant nuts or pods, and that when sailors sleep on the deck because it is hot, flit down upon them, and then, in the morning, are found dead men, white, even as Miss Lucy was? Good God, Professor, I said, starting up. Do you mean to tell me that Lucy was bitten by such a bat? And that such a thing is here in London in the 19th century? He waved his hand for silence and went on. Can you tell me why the tortoise lives more long than generations of men, Why the elephant goes on and on and on till I've seen dynasties. Why the parrot never die only of bite or cat or dog or other complaint. Can you tell me why men believe in all ages and places that there are few who live on always if they be permit? That there are men and women who cannot die? We all know, because science has vouched for the facts, that there have been toads shut up in rocks for thousands of years, shut in one so small hole only hold him since the youth of the world. Can you tell me how the Indian fakir can make himself to die and have been buried, and his grave sealed, and corn sowed on it, and corn reaped and cut and sown and reaped and cut again, and the men come and take away the unbroken seal, and there lie that Indian faker, not dead, but that rise up and walk amongst them as before? Here I interrupted him. I was getting bewildered. He so crowded on my mind his list of nature's eccentricities and possible impossibilities that my imagination was getting fired. I had a dim idea that he was teaching me some lesson, as long ago he used to do in his study at Amsterdam, but he used then to tell me the thing so I could have the object of thought in mind all the time. Now I was without this help, and yet I wanted to follow him, so I said, "Professor, let me be your pet student again. Tell me the thesis, so I may apply your knowledge as you go on. At present, I'm going in my mind from point to point as a madman, and not a sane one follows ideas. I feel like a novice blundering through a bog in the mist, jumping from one tussock to another in a mere blind effort to move on without knowing where I'm going." "That is good image," he said. "Well, I should tell you. My thesis is this. I want you to believe."
"To believe what?"
"To believe in things you cannot. Let me illustrate. I heard once of an American who so defined faith, that which enables us to believe things which we know to be untrue. For one, I follow that man. He meant that we shall have an open mind, and not let a little bit of truth check the rush of a big truth, like a small rock does a railway track. We get to the small truth first. Good. We keep him, we value him, but all the same, we must not let him think himself all the truth in the universe."
"Then you want me to not let some previous conviction injure the receptivity of my mind with regard to some strange matter? Do I read your lesson all right?"
"Ah, you are my favorite pupil still. It is worth to teach you. Now that you are willing to understand, you have taken the first step to understand. You think, then, that those so small holes in the children's throats were made by the same that made the hole in Miss Lucy?"
"I suppose so."
He stood up and said solemnly, "Then you are wrong."
"Oh, would it were so. But alas, no. It is worse. Far, far worse."
"In God's name, Professor Van Helsing, what do you mean?" I cried. He threw himself with a despairing gesture into a chair, placed his elbows on the table, covering his face with his hands as he spoke. "They were made by Miss Lucy." Dr. Seward's diary continued. For a while, sheer anger mastered me. It was as if he had, during her life, struck Lucy on the face. I smote the table hard and rose up as I said to him, "Dr. Van Helsing, are you mad?" He raised his head and looked at me, and somehow the tenderness of his face calmed me at once. "Would I were," he said. "Madness were easy to bear compared with truth like this. Oh, my friend, why think you, or did I go so far round? Why tale you told so long to tell you such a simple thing? Was it because I hate you and have hated you all my life? Was it because I wished to give you pain? Was it now I wanted, now so late, revenge for the time you saved my life and from a fearful death? Ah, no. Forgive me," I said. He went on. "My friend, it was because I wished to be gentle in the breaking to you. For I know you've loved that so sweet lady. But even yet I do not expect you to believe. It is so hard to accept at once any abstract truth, that we may doubt such to be possible when we've always believed the know of it. It is more hard still to accept so sad a concrete truth, and of such a one as Miss Lucy. Tonight I go to prove it. Dare you come with me?" This staggered me. A man does not like to prove such a truth.
Byron accepted from the category jealousy. Prove the truth he most abhorred. He saw my hesitation and spoke. The logic is simple. No madman's logic this time, jumping from tussock to tussock in a misty bog. If it be not true, then proof will be relief. At worst, it will not harm. If it be true, ah, there is the dread. Yet, very dread should help my cause, for in it is some need of belief. Come, I tell you what I propose. First, we go off now and see that child in the hospital. Dr. Vincent, in the North Hospital, where the papers say the child is a friend of mine. And I think of yours, since you were in class at Amsterdam. He will let two scientists see his case, if he will not let two friends. We shall tell him nothing, only that we wish to learn. And then? And then? He took a key from his pocket and held it up. And then we spend the night, you and I, in the churchyard where Lucy lies. This is the key that locked the tomb. I had it from the coffin man to give to Arthur. My heart sank within me, for I felt that there was some fearful ordeal before us. I could do nothing, however, so I plucked up what heart I could and said we better hasten, as the afternoon was passing. We found the child awake. It had had some sleep and taken some food, and altogether was going on well. Dr. Vincent took the bandage from its throat and showed us the punctures. There was no mistaking the similarity to those which had been on Lucy's throat. They were smaller, and the edges looked fresher. That was all. We asked Vincent to what he attributed them, and he replied it must have been a bite of some animal, perhaps a rat. But for his own part, he was inclined to think that it was one of the bats which are so numerous in the northern heights of London. Out of so many harmless ones, he said, there may be some wild specimen from the south of a more malignant species. Some sailor might have brought one home, and it managed to escape. Or even the zoological gardens a young one may have got loose, or one be bred there from a vampire. These things do occur, you know. Only 10 days ago a wolf got out, and was, I believe, traced up in this direction. For a week after, the children were playing nothing but Red Riding Hood on the heath, and in every valley in the place until this Bluefer lady came along, and since then it had been quite a gala time with them. Even this poor little mite, when he got up today, asked the nurse if he might go away. When she asked him why he wanted to go, he said he wanted to play with the Bluefer lady. "I hope," said Van Helsing, "that you are sending the child home, and you will caution its parents to keep strict watch over it. These fancies to stray are most dangerous, and if the child were to remain out another night, it would probably be fatal. In any case, I suppose you will not let it away for some days." "Oh, certainly not, not for a week at least, longer if the wound is not healed." Our visit to the hospital took some more time than we'd reckoned on, and the sun had dipped before we came out. When Van Helsing saw how dark it was, he said, "There is no hurry. It is more late than I thought. Come, let us seek somewhere that we may eat, and then we shall go on our way." We dined at Jack Straw's castle, along with a little crowd of bicyclists and others who were genially noisy. About 10 o'clock we started from the inn. It was then very dark, and the scattered lamps made the darkness greater when we were once outside their individual radius. The professor had evidently noted the road we were to go, for he went on unhesitatingly. But as for me, I was in quite a mix-up as to locality. When we went further, we met fewer and fewer people, till at last we were somewhat surprised when we met even the patrol of horse police going around their usual suburban round. At last we reached the wall of the churchyard, which we climbed over. With some little difficulty, for it was very dark, the whole place seemed so strange to us. We found the Westonra tomb. The professor took the key, opened the creaky door, and standing back politely but quite unconsciously motioned me to precede him. There was such a delicious irony in the offer, in the courtliness of giving preference on such a ghastly occasion. My companion followed me quickly and cautiously drew the door to, after carefully ascertaining that the lock was a falling and not a spring one. In the latter case, we should have been in a bad plight. And then he fumbled in his bag, and taking out a matchbox and a piece of candle, proceeded to make a light. The tomb in the daytime, and when wreathed with fresh flowers, had looked grim and gruesome enough. But now, some days afterwards, when the flowers hung lank and dead, their whites turning to rust and their greens to browns, when the spider and beetle had resumed their accustomed dominance, when time-discolored stone and dust-encrusted mortar and rusty dank iron and tarnished brass and clouded silver plating gave back the feeble glimmer of a candle, the effect was more miserable and sordid than could have been imagined. It conveyed irresistibly that life, animal life, was not the only thing which could pass away. Van Helsing went about his work systematically, holding his candle so he could read the coffin plates and holding it so that the sperm dropped in white patches, which congealed as they touched the metal. He made assurance of Lucy's coffin. Another search in his bag, and he took out a turn screw. "What are you going to do?" I asked. "To open the coffin. You shall yet be convinced." Straightway he began taking out the screws and finally lifted off the lid, showing the casing of lead beneath. The sight was almost too much for me. It seemed to be as much of an affront to the dead as it would have been to have stripped off her clothing in her sleep whilst living. I actually took hold of his hand to stop him. He only said, "You shall see," and again fumbling in his bag, took out a tiny fret saw. Striking the turn screw through the lead with a swift downward stab made me wince. He made a small hole, which was, however, big enough to admit the point of the saw. I had expected a rush of gas from the weak old corpse. We doctors who have to study our dangers have to become accustomed to such things, and I drew back from the door. But the professor never stopped for a moment. He sawed down a couple of feet, one along one side of the lead coffin, and then across, and back down the other side. Taking the edge of the loose flange, he bent it back towards the foot of the coffin, and holding up the candle into the aperture, motioned me to look. I drew near, and looked. The coffin was empty. It was certainly a surprise to me, and gave me a considerable shock, but Van Helsing was unmoved. He was now more sure than ever of his ground, and so emboldened to proceed in his task. "Are you satisfied now, friend John?" he asked. I felt all the dogged argumentativeness of my nature awaken within me as I answered him. "I am satisfied that Lucy's body is not in that coffin, but that only proves one thing." "And what is that, friend John?" "That it is not there." "That is good logic," he said, "so far as it goes. But how can you account for it not being there?" "Perhaps a body snatcher," I suggested. "Some of the undertaker's people may have stolen it." I felt I was speaking folly, and yet it was the only real cause I could suggest. The professor sighed. "Ah, well," he said, "we must have more proof. Come with me." He put on the coffin lid again, gathered up all his things and placed them in the bag, blew out the light and placed the candle also in the bag. We opened the door and went out. Behind us, he closed the door and locked it. He handed me the key, saying, "Will you keep it? You'd better be assured." I laughed. It was not a very cheerful laugh, I'm bound to say, as I motioned him to keep it. "A key is nothing," I said. "There may be duplicates, and anyhow, it's not difficult to pick a lock of that kind." He said nothing, but put the key in his pocket. Then he told me to watch one side of the churchyard whilst he would watch at the other. I took up my place behind a yew tree and saw his dark figure move until the intervening headstones and trees hid it from my sight. It was a lonely vigil. Just after I'd taken my place, I heard a distant clock strike 12, and then in time came 1 and 2. I was chilled and unnerved, angry with the professor for taking me on such an errand, and with myself for coming. I was too cold and too sleepy to be keenly observant, and not sleepy enough to betray my trust, so altogether I had a dreary, miserable time. Suddenly, as I turned around, I thought I saw something like a white streak moving between 2 dark yew trees at the side of the courtyard farthest from the tomb. At the same time, a dark mass moved from the professor's side of the ground and hurriedly went towards it. Then I too moved, but I had to go around headstones and railed off tombs, and I stumbled over graves. The sky was overcast, and somewhere far off, the early cock crew. A little way off, beyond a line of scattered juniper trees, which marked the pathway of the church, a dim, white figure flitted in the direction of the tomb. This has been Rachel reading Bookshelf with part 8 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Have a wonderful day.